On the latest episode of Real Health with me, Carl Henry, I'm delighted to be joined by trichologist Claire Fulham, chatting all things hair loss.
I remember then going, I'm losing a bit more hair. Like, I could see hair everywhere. It was all over my desk and work everywhere. And so I went to my GP. She found five big patches on my scalp, one the size of my fist. So I was like, right, what am I going to do about this? Give me a plan. She just looked me dead in the eye and said, there's nothing you can do. I went on list for dermatologists. She had a cancellation and she very quickly said, yes, you have alopecia areata.
As ever, available on all podcast platforms.
An Irish Independent digital subscription doesn't just get you the news. It gets you the best of Ireland's stories all in one place. Whether it's the best of politics, business, sport, entertainment or lifestyle. Get it all for just €4 a month for 12 months when you first subscribe. Visit independent.ie/subscribe today. Irish Independent. Terms and conditions apply. Cancel anytime.
Listen and follow the Left Wing Rugby podcast with me, Will Slattery and Luke Fitzgerald.
As far as I can see, I always want to get in the Irish team. And that should be every young player's dream and ambition in this country. And if you're playing in a place where you're not going to get the opportunities in the big games, that they're the ones that get you picked. They are the ones, the Champions Cup games are the ones that get you picked. You need to be playing in a team and starting in a team for those games. It's as simple as that if you want to play in the Irish team.
Every week on Apple, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every major criminal that I have ever written about, there is a template to their stories. And that is that you have a young bit of a thug on the streets, gets involved in crime, gets gradually more involved in more serious crime, has certain qualities that differentiate him from the rest of the mob or the pack, and he emerges as a leader as time goes on. And they will either end up being arrested and put in prison, or else they end up dead. They're the only two alternatives.
Gangland, like the world of business or politics, is often based on a succession of personnel. A run of good form that eventually comes to an end, which sees the players involved either pass the mantle down to the next guard or become forced out by a ruthless competitor.
They said, you continue running the business. We'll back you, but you had to get rid of him.
Between 1996 and 2010, Ireland witnessed multiple transitions of godfather-like figures who rose to the top of the organised crime trade.
He did bring a level of organisation to the drug trade that hadn't been seen at this stage. He brought a business approach to it.
Before meeting their end in a gruesome and deadly manner.
He had one bullet hole in his head, the forehead. His head was back on the headrest.
I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today on the Indo Daily, in the first in our Gangland Succession trilogy, I'm joined by special correspondent Paul Williams to look at the checkered and dangerous past of one of Ireland's most violent career criminals. This is the story of the psycho, PJ Judge. Paul, can you start by telling us, who was PJ Judge? What was his background?
Well, PJ Judge, I suppose the best way to describe him, Fionnán, would be that he was one of the pathfinders of the modern drug trade that we have today. And we probably had said that about quite a few criminals through the years. But this guy was certainly one of the first really brutal godfathers who appeared on the gangland scene, who actually started the trend of gangland murders. If you met him, he looked anything but a dangerous criminal. He had a very calm and reassuring voice, spoke with a Dublin brogue, very nasally, but he was almost like, if you met him on the street, you say, that guy's like an innocent civil servant. Wore the best of casual clothes, very best clothes, always very well groomed. He'd help old ladies across the road. He looked after his widowed mother. He loved animals. He ostensibly liked people. But behind that facade lurked what I described in the past as a sort of a chilling, cold-blooded monster. He was a total psychopath. Thus, we put the nickname on him many years ago, the psycho.
What was his start in the criminal world?
Guards who knew him from he was a kid, from the time of about 10, said there was a kink in him. There was something different about him. He started getting in trouble with the police around 10. By the time he was 12, he was convicted of larceny, assault and burglary. When he was 14, and this would sort of sum up his personality or the type of individual he was hanging out with kids from down the road. He grew up in Finglas, and these kids convinced him that it was a good idea to dye his hair. So he dyed his hair and they brought him in, dyed his hair, made it look like it could be hijit. And he went home and all his mates up around Finglas on his road said, these people made a fool of you. So as a 14-year-old, he went down, he broke into a local gunsmith's shop, got a gun and brought it to the house where one of the main ringleader in the dye brigade and fired shots at it and got his first time in prison when he went to a reformatory school. When he came out of prison a couple of years later, out of reform school, he went back to the same gunsmith, stole more guns and this time fired shots at a kid who had been slagging him or bullying him. So that's the kind of individual you have. And from that on, he was associated with armed robbery. He shot a guard or went to shoot a guard. He shot a post office worker and he got something like 10 years in prison in the early parts of the 80s. When he came out of in prison in 1989, he followed the trend that the other criminals like the John Gilligans and people were starting to follow and that he started moving into drugs.
Yet, he was considered intelligent. In what way did that manifest itself?
He was a very sharp, intelligent sort of guy. You'd meet him and he'd be very articulate. And as I say, he had that facade of being a sort of calm, well-spoken guy. But he did bring a level of organisation to the drug trade that hadn't been seen at this stage. He brought a business approach to it. He first of all started working in cannabis and then continued in the cannabis racket, but moved into heroin, ecstasy and amphetamine, which were huge in the early 90s.
In the last few years, ecstasy has become widely available in Ireland, from Donegal to Cork.
What pushers often do is that they will give a youngster 10 tablets to sell. If they sell these tablets, then they can get two tablets for themselves. It seems to be widely available in streets in Dublin, in colleges, and perhaps even down the more affluent Leeson Street type areas.
His business model was that he never, ever allowed credit. This was a business method or model that was followed by other criminals. And you might think, that would make sense. No, it doesn't. Like everyone wants lay on, as it's called, or get stuff on take. If you were a lazy drug dealer, and he had loads of them, he used to sack them. But if he sacked you, because such was his influence after a very short while, that if you were a drug addict and you were selling stuff, you could take your gear on your own time. You weren't going to rip him off. You had to pay the bills. And if you didn't, you were taken away, beaten and shot or battered. But if you didn't do your job, he would sack you. And then no other drug dealer would allow you to work for him because such was his influence. So people would cold shoulder you. You'd become almost like a pariah. He's not reliable. Don't talk to him. So he was the very first person to develop a model like that.
To have an actual, literally organized crime around the drugs industry.
Absolutely.
Again, all in inverted commas. What was the Garda view of him at that point? So we're now in the early 90s. He's come out of prison, so he's well known to the guards at this point. They know that he's involved in the drugs trade. Was it that he was so organized and sharp about his business enterprise there that effectively they couldn't lay a hand on him?
I remember talking to the former Garda Commissioner, Noel Conroy, who'd been a detective out there as a young detective, and he said, you know, any of these guys I interviewed through the years, they would say to me from the first time we saw this guy that they thought he was going to be a wrong one, as they say, that he was standing out from the crowd as a particularly vicious and nasty creature who instilled terror in everybody he went dealt with. And they called him a natural born killer. Another dimension to his personality, by the way, which are his, the kind of individual he was to explain him. He was bisexual and he clearly had a problem with that. And there was ample and humongous amount of evidence. And I interviewed his victims, both young men, young boys, and young lads who were drug addicts. Like he sexually abused and assaulted them, raped them, as he did young women. And in fact, he used to beat the living daylights out of his girlfriends. He used to hang out with girls who were on the game or whatever. And one time, he beat the living daylights out of this girl. I interviewed her afterwards. She was a prostitute at the time. And she ran into the Bridewell Garda station screaming for help and him coming in after her. So he could be really calm, but the temper would turn white hot and he came through the door after her and the cop who stopped him actually said to me at the time afterwards, he said, that guy, it was pure evil, come in the door. So that was another aspect to him and he was prolific at this. He went to Amsterdam one time with a guy called Michael Godfrey to buy dope directly from the suppliers. And that would have been very modest at times, about 10 or 20 grand's worth of a deal. When he brought it over here, he said to Godfrey, that's not the dope I bought. That's not the hash I bought. That's substandard. I don't want that. I want my money back. This Godfrey fellow was a sort of a fraudster. And he ran with a guy called Stephen Rossi Walsh, a notorious criminal. Judge discovered that Godfrey sold the dope to Peter Fatso Mitchell and Brian Meehan, who are up-and-coming lieutenants around that time of one John Gillian. And he literally went one night with his sawn-off shotgun to shoot them because he was angry that they got this dope and then sold it for a big profit. And eventually then he went and took Godfrey, had him abducted from the North Circular Road. Another horrific type of case, because he brought him to this place, which was his Killingfield in Scribblestown Lane. He brought Godfrey there with another guy and told the guy to shoot him. And the guy shot him but didn't kill him, and your man was still alive. And PJ Judge, this guy later described it. PJ Judge put one in the back of his head and walked away as if it was like he was after putting down a rabid animal or whatever, and didn't give a damn because he knew nobody would ever come near him. He started building himself around that, and there were a few other shootings and people taken away and tortured and beaten. By the time I came across him, in the mid-90s, he was firmly in control. He was the major godfather at that time.
And were there other murders that he was associated with?
There were a number of other murders, but particularly the one murder that does put me in contact with him or in conflict with him or in his crosshairs. There was a small-time criminal called William Jock Corbley, and he lived across the road from a really charming, charismatic guy. Chancer, a failed criminal, really. And he was a sort of a half informant of mine. And we were all young and innocent at the time. And he was a very likable guy. He was always looking for the big job. And he ended up getting involved in this heroin deal. And Jock couldn't do anything straight. And he ended up trying to rip off his partners in crime. And the heroin was found. But when the heroin was found, the guards reported the amount that they found. It was an awful lot less than what he had brought in from Amsterdam with a fellow called Declan Decky Griffin. And at that stage, Jock Corbley had always stood up to Judge on the street because he was stronger than him and he was a very good-looking guy. And Judge had this massive hang-up about him. And this gave Judge an excuse to say, I'm going to do him. So what he did in February of 1996 was he arranged with Decky Griffin and another fellow called Mark Dwyer to meet Jock in Chapelizod and bring him for a meeting. They were going to go to dig up guns and drugs in a field near Baldonnell. Griffin drove into the field with his victim. Now, Griffin told me all of this afterwards. He's since been killed himself. And Judge peers out of the dark and says, we're waiting for you for a long time. He took him out. And anyway, he set about torturing him and beating him. And the fellows who were with him, who were hardened psychopaths themselves, they were shocked by what he did. One of the things he did, Jock had a perfect set of teeth. And it was his, the women loved him and everything, and he had all these big smiley faces on him. And Judge didn't like that. So Judge got an iron bar and smashed in every one of his teeth. He stabbed him several times, and then he dumped him into the boot of a car, and he drove off, and he dumped his body in an unmarked grave, and his body has never been found since.
You mentioned that you came on Judge's radar at that point. In what way?
A few cops said to me, you need to look at this PJ Judge fella. This is something else, this fella. This is a serious player. So I met the brothers of Jock, who I got to know very, very well. And I also then started doing my own inquiries and meeting people. And the one thing I got from everybody was how absolutely terrified they were of this guy. This guy was running the city with literally a reign of terror. That even the likes of the Gilligans would be stepping away from him. So we don't want to mess with this guy, even though they were probably on a much bigger scale at that time, or as big a scale. So I started looking into him and I started building this picture of him. And we finally ran the story in the Sunday World. And it was done strategically because the guards approached my editor at the time, Colin McGinty, and said, listen, you guys are going after this fellow. Judge is an exceptionally dangerous man. He will kill your reporter. That's what they came to say to him. And like at the time we were saying, well, we're in the business of producing stories. So what I did do, and I conceded in doing, was myself and the wife and the kids were going away on holidays in May. So we ran the story, the big expose, with just the psycho, gangland you psycho, an executioner, on the front page, and left for 3 weeks to go on holidays. When I was away, the first week I got phone calls that him and his right-hand man, who was one Martin Marlow Highland, who we'd be talking about again, there was a big meeting at his house, which was monitored from a distance by the police. And at that meeting, he said, I want this fella killed, but I also want him taken away, but I want him tortured. I want to find out exactly what he knows. I came back from holidays, and literally that week when I came back, Jerry McKay was murdered by the Provisional IRA in Limerick. And then 2 to 3 weeks later, while I was still working on the PJ Judge follow-up stories and still doing something, Veronica was murdered. And then the world changed.
Good evening. There has been widespread condemnation of the killing of the crime reporter Veronica Guerin, who was shot in Dublin this afternoon. As Guerin was gunned down in her car as she waited at traffic lights on the Naas dual carriageway. Two men on a Dublin-registered motorbike drove alongside. The pillion passenger opened fire.
I went back after Judge again, say a couple of weeks after Veronica's murder, because there was so much happening. And at that stage, he put out a contract to such an extent that the police were informed, one of the guys who took the contract to abduct me for Judge, to torture me and do all the things he wanted to do, he went to the police and said, this is mad. I don't want to do this. And he actually informed the police that one of the things they were going to do was ambush me on Whitehall Road in Terranure when I was going home from the Sunday World. It was in Terranure at the time. Going on by, I used to live the walking sound at the time. And then they tried to lure me into a trap. Coincidentally, the father of a notorious hitman for the Kinnans, who is now doing life for 20 years in prison in Spain, Quinn, his outfella, was involved in this plot. And they nearly got me at the time to lure me out because one of Martin Cahill, the general's brothers, was on the run at the time and was prepared to come in. And he escaped from police custody. And this was the ruse. They nearly got me in a club, this place beside this club where I was supposed to meet these people one night in Clondalkin in around September of 1996. Anyway, that was my thing with him. And then the police, I found a report only recently. The police came to me and said, look, this guy is going to kill you. And they were watching him all the time. They were watching me. And then eventually in December, I think it was December the 7th of 1996, PJ Judge was in the pub in Fingus, left the pub with his girlfriend who happened to be the sister of Martin Marlowe Hyland. And just before he left the pub, Marlowe left the company and went and made a phone call in the old coin phone in the pub. And as he sat into the car, Judge, this guy appeared out of nowhere and shot him numerous times in the head. PJ Judge was allowed to survive and prosper for numerous years because of his relationship with the Provisional IRA in Finglas and Cabra. And that tradition was taken up by his sidekick, who was Martin Marlowe Hyland, would continued for his time in the Sunset. And the concerned parents at the time, which was infiltrated by the Provost and the IRA.
This was the vigilante group that was going around
groups,
to dealers' houses. Yeah.
So what they did was, I remember a young lad, it always sticks out in my mind, a young lad was taken out because he was selling a bit of gear, and they sliced him with a Stanley blade on his bare buttocks to humiliate him and cause him enough pain in front of the whole community. And I remember writing a story about that, how the provos, like this sick morality of these people, they're quietly being paid tribute by the likes of this guy, the psycho, we hadn't named who it named them at that stage. And yet they were bullying young kids and terrorizing people and trying to get PR out of it. So they decided, the provos, in conjunction with Marlowe, they said to Marlowe, you continue running the business. We'll back you. But you had to get rid of him. We'll help you. And Marlowe Hyland, who was his psychic, he was his understudy. He was not as bad as PJ Judge in terms of that. He didn't have that absolutely cold-blooded, monstrous side to his personality. He did what he was told to do, but also he did it because he knew he had to do it. Because Judge, with the murder of Jock Corbley and all these other murders he was trying to do, like saying that he was going to murder a journalist a couple of months after Veronica was murdered, purely he didn't give a shit about that. He just said, I don't care. I'm going to still do it. And the police, he was the next big thing on their radar. As soon as they ended the Veronica Guerin investigation, they're going to go after him. He gets whacked in the middle of it and everybody's happy.
And yet, Marlowe Hyland's sister is actually with him in the car when he's shot. So Marlowe Hyland actually jeopardized the life of his own sister, which just shows you what
absolutely,
the ruthlessness of gangland.
It's important to point out about her. She had a normal relationship with PJ Judge. He didn't beat her up and he didn't abuse her. He did all that to all these other people, and perhaps because he'd respect for the Hyland family. One of the things he did, by the way, as well, just before, in September of 96, there was a fella called Michael Brady, who was a brother-in-law of Marlowe Hyland. Several years earlier, Michael Brady had been married to Marlowe's sister, but he murdered her one night. He was a very violent thug and he beat his wife to death. And he came out of prison in the early part of 96. But on a September evening, and the reason I can relate this to you with the clarity that I am, is that I was in a pub just around the corner, happened to be. And somebody came in. It was a pub where a lot of guards used to hang out. So we said, there's been a shooting around the corner. And so we all ran around the corner and He was under an apartment block on Aran Quay. And I remember there was a couple of uniformed guards putting up the tape, and they said, "Paul, would you go and have a look at him and see, do you recognise him? Because we can't work out who he is." And that was when I got in to stand, and they asked me. I was fascinated by it because, okay, a few months earlier I saw Veronica Guerin dead in the car, but not in the same way. He had one bullet hole in his head, in the forehead, and his head was back on the headrest, and they had finished him. I was fascinated by it, and then somebody else said, "What's that fella doing in there?" I didn't know who he was, but that was a hit he did with Marlo Hyland on behalf of Marlo Hyland's family to get rid of the man who murdered his sister. But despite that, less than 3 months later, Marlo whacks his mentor and his friend.
Business, I think
it's not personal, it's business.
Yeah, yeah.
What it does do is when you tell the story, I find myself telling the story again, it really is, that is the template that Gangland has operated under ever since. And that's why this whole story of succession in this particular case, because Marlo Hyland takes over and it's the same thing. A guy becomes really big. He builds himself a little empire. He starts becoming a nuisance. He believes his own nonsense and propaganda and thinks he's invincible and is a monstrous individual. And because of that, people decide he has to go. To use Jerry Hutch's line from the famous tapes that we were listening to earlier this year, you know, they have to go. That's the parlance for saying he has to be shot.
Next time on the Indo Daily, a gangland succession.
They shot this mum 4 or 5 times in the chest as she stood having a cigarette at her apartment door in Source. It was a horrific case. It completely took over the headlines. So we start writing about it and everybody knows Marlo's involved. So this is a really bad step.
And my thanks to Paul Williams. I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today's episode of The Indo Daily was produced by Garrett Mulhall and Ian Doyle, researched by Dave Hanratty, with sound by John Smith. Archive clips from RTE News and The Irish Independent. If you enjoy The Indo Daily, follow and leave us a review.
Shachtan, an Indo Askeliga.
Lower and Wanchirna Elner Donaldson Lish and Ifagachin Akanir Lower Jeffrey the Dinyerby.
Ni Heg Willem Policy Shachan, Ian Rodayanu and Avira Lestad occur Leshnabaj Bogashoot.
Skilty, Fis, Turmi.
Nimajigiri and Dram Honyal Ama, Tamajigiri Munchen Honyalista.
Shachtan, find us on all the usual podcast platforms.